Welcome to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast with Julian Castelli. Each week, we talk with senior tech leaders to explore stories and insights about the challenges involved with growing technology companies. We hope that these stories can help you become a better leader and help you navigate your own growth journey.
Hi, this is Julian Castelli. I'm the host of the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast, where each week I talk with inspirational entrepreneurs and leaders in the tech industry. Past guests have included CEOs and CXOs of great companies like Workfront, CHG Healthcare, Retica Systems, InMoment, VoxPopMe, the San Francisco 49ers, and many more. This podcast is brought to you by Growth Elevated. At Growth Elevated, we're a community of tech founders, CEOs, and CXOs who are committed to working together to share best practices and learnings in an effort to help all of us become better leaders. We do this through educational programs like this podcast. We also have a blog, and we have an annual tech summit in the mountains of beautiful Park City, Utah. So if you want to learn about leadership, and if you like skiing, check out growthelevated.com and our annual tech summit. We'd love to see you there. Today, I am super excited to welcome Cotter Cunningham to the podcast. Cotter is the CEO of Expert Voice. Expert Voice helps some of the world's best brands build deeper relationships with their most influential advocates in retail stores, professional settings, and online. All of this is done to improve the strength and reach of trusted recommendations that help customers buy more confidently. Prior to Expert Voice, Cotter was the CEO of Retail Me Not. Retail Me Not is a leading savings destination that enables brands to engage active shoppers and influence purchasing decisions. Cotter founded Retail Me Not in 2009 and served as CEO through 2018 and chairman through 2020. As CEO, Cotter grew revenues from zero to almost $300 million and grew the business to 650 employees, all while remaining profitable. He also raised over $250 million from a number of different investors, including Austin Ventures, Norwest Venture Partners, GV, IVP, and JP Morgan. Cotter is now a venture partner at Next Coast Ventures, and that's where I had the good fortune to get to know him. He is also a husband and a father of three kids and lives in beautiful Austin, Texas. Please welcome Cotter Cunningham.
Yay. Hey, Cotter. Thanks for the intro. That was fun.
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to hearing a little bit about the journey and some of the stories. So, congratulations on all the success. Before we start talking about your company in Utah, which I'm tempted to do, let's go back a little bit to Retail Me Not. That's an interesting company, right?
Yeah.
I look at it and I've used it for some coupons occasionally. And so I look at it as kind of an e-commerce type of site. But tell me a little bit about how you got started with Retail Me Not. What was the original idea? And did you have to iterate a little bit to get to where it was?
Yeah, it's a crazy story. So I was an entrepreneur in residence at Austin Ventures and kind of looking for a business. And we stumbled, I'd played around with coupons before. There used to be a company called Fat Wallet that did like rewards and cash back. And there was a couple of kind of smaller coupon players. And I started investigating the space, and it sounds so obnoxious to say this, so forgive me, but everybody I met was like a solo entrepreneur. Inevitably, their background wasn't marketing or anything like that. It was kind of scrappy entrepreneurial types. And I felt like, and a lot of them were kind of approaching it sort of part-time and things like that. And so my thesis was, what if you had one of these and you ran it like a business, as opposed to sort of like a hobby that funded your lifestyle? And because some of them had pretty amazing lifestyles. And I remember we bought three small companies on one day, and we ran those for a year.
With an acquisition. So you had a concept, but you found some small players and said, let's build a base.
That's right. And
was the general idea the digitization of coupons going from paper to online, or not so much?
Not so much. It was really more just that, at the time, the big thesis was the one I mentioned, that these were sort of run unprofessionally, but the sort of underlying sort of theme, I think, is this idea that at the time, e-commerce represented maybe 10% of the typical wallet spend. And of course, you feel like over time, it's going to be 90. Mm-hmm. And so let's ride that growth up. And it proved right. I mean, I don't know the exact, I hadn't checked the exact percentages lately, but it's certainly a bigger share of wallet for the average consumer today than it was when I started in 2009.
So help describe the ecosystem, right? Because I know it as a place, as a consumer, as a shopper, I can get a discount, but how are you getting those discounts and bring them together? And how are they unique discounts that you have at RetailMeNot versus others, or are you a marketplace of discounts?
Yeah. So RetailMeNot was really innovative. It was started by two gentlemen from Melbourne, Australia. Like I said, I bought it about a year after we started with three other sites, and it quickly became the star of our little portfolio. And so we wound up sort of closing or winding down or just de-emphasizing the original three brands and putting all of our eggs into RetailMeNot and literally changed the name of the company confusingly.
I was going to ask you where that name came from. So that was the Australian company's name?
Yeah, it's the Australian company's name. It's kind of a weird story. The guy had started a site called Bug Me Not, which was a way where a lot of the news sites, this is 2009, it was a different world, had
the early days of the domain names and the great real estate grab, right?
Yeah, 100%. And so a lot of the news sites had started requiring you to register. And so the whole concept behind Bug Me Not was you would register with generic like username and password and you would post it. And so I could go into Bug Me Not and grab that username and password. And so I wouldn't have to register. I could use yours or something.
You're jointly.
So it's kind of this fun UGC approach.
A little
and
hack.
So in a way, that's the way they approached coupons. It was genius at the time. The interesting thing about, so the ecosystem works like this. They're online retailers and consumers. And so they're looking for traffic. Mm-hmm. And so they use coupons as a way to drive traffic from consumers. And so the interesting part about coupons is you don't get paid on the use of the coupon. You get paid just for the traffic. So in other words, you're cookied on RetailMeNot, and then we deliver you to, you know, Kohl's or Macy's or whatever. And so that winds up in a paid transaction, regardless of if you use a coupon anything like that.
Yeah, it's paid for traffic. Okay.
Yeah. And so the a typical commission, I think it's been pushed down pretty hard now. I'm not in the business anymore, but at the time it was around 5%, so not huge money, but you know, if you do enough of them, it adds up.
Is this part of what's called affiliate marketing and affiliate traffic? 100%. Okay, that's the category. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, and there are a couple of fun things about that, not the least of which was every retailer has an affiliate marketing team. And so you had a clear customer who needed you and got bonused on, you know, whether or not you were able to drive traffic to them. So there was a definite win there, as opposed to a lot of businesses like the one I'm in now. We don't have a clear customer always. And so it can be challenging sometimes to say, hey, you know, you need us. And the guy's like, or girl or woman is like, do I? So that's a thing. So anyway, there's a clear customer.
The person in the marketing department. He's got a budget for affiliate traffic. Their job is to drive traffic. And what would you provide them?
Yeah, traffic. Literally.
Would you provide them a tool set to build these coupons?
That's the best part of affiliate. So it's all pre-done. There are these couple of sites. Rakuten has one. It used to be Commission Junction and Linkshare back in the day. And so all the plumbing has been put in place. So you can actually run a coupon site with a very minimal sales group. Now, we wound up really ramping up our sales group because we found that the more interactions you had with these affiliate managers, the better coupons you would get, the more exclusives you would get, the access to more interesting deals and stuff you would get. But the fun thing about RetailMeNot, and I don't want to miss this point, is kind of what we were talking about before. It let consumers post UGC, user generated content on the site. So if you were out and about,
and that
you
were early days where that became really critical, right?
Right.
And you were an avenue for that, or you helped them give, you know, facilitate that. So
if you found a fun coupon for Gap or whatever. You could post it on RetailMeNot. You got points. We didn't actually pay you or anything.
Oh, did you gamify it a bit?
We gamified it a little bit. And then the other thing that I think really helped is when you would post the coupon, you, the consumer, you would write it in a way that used your voice. And so it helped in SEO a ton because you would typically describe the coupon or whatever the benefits were in the way that a consumer would think, not the way that a marketer would think. So mm-hmm. The example I always use is like women's pants. They don't always call them pants in the ads. They call them slacks or something like bottoms. But you don't call them that. No human in the conversation would ever call them bottoms.
Maybe for babies.
Pants. And so, you know, it would be $5 off women's pants at Kohl's, and you'd post that. And so I think that really helped. Anyway, we wound up buying that company, and then it was a rocket ship for the first 4 or 5 years. It was really incredible.
And so you bought those startup companies, you kind of narrowed it down to the RetailMeNot business, and then you just really started building on that business model?
Yeah. That's exactly right. About 2 years in, we started expanding internationally. So I bought coupon sites in the UK, a company called Voucher Codes. We bought 3 sites in France and sort of pushed them together. We did some work in Germany, which was hard. We never really mastered Germany, for better or worse. We did some stuff in Australia. So yeah, we definitely sort of expanded that way. And then we started playing around with, obviously, the things that were to come. So cashback being a big one, browser extensions being mm-hmm. huge.
So you really became, you know, kind of the cutting edge of online traffic and generation and affiliate marketing and understanding all those things.
Yeah. I mean, one of the leaders. There were certainly people in it with us.
And so what were the stages? Like, you obviously, you went all the way. You went public, hundreds of millions of dollars. But what were the high-level stages if you had to break the journey down? Startup phase, maybe growth stage, and then public stage.
Yeah, so we started with no employees, you know, just me in a tiny little office in the basement of Austin Ventures. And Austin Ventures gave me $30 million, about 28, to buy
the... That's a good start.
Good start. Yeah. And if you start with 30 million in your pocket, you're not doing anything wrong to buy the 3 original sites. So they were all growing nicely and had pretty good revenues and pretty good growth. Our revenues were about 10 million to 12 million, kind of in that
after
range.
After you consolidated those. So you started at zero, then you got a big step change to 10.
That's right.
What was the next goal when you started at 10? You're trying to get to where?
My whole goal was to get to 100 million.
Okay.
I'd been at Bankrate, a company in South Florida, before that. And we had worked, I'd had 3 different CEOs, and we had been gone from about 50 million to about 80 million during that time. I was there 10 years, I think, roughly. And we never could get to 100 million. It always was this kind of,
so you came in with that bogey very well, yeah. well entrenched in your mind.
No, yeah. I mean, the I can't even describe it. It seemed almost unobtainable. And the joke is at RetailMeNot, I think we got there in about a year.
1 year?
The second year. First year after we bought it. Yeah. It was doing about 30 million the day we bought it. And I think within a year, we were doing almost 100. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So that journey that you set yourself up for, you know, this might take 3, 5, 10 years, 1 year to 100 million. Okay. So that, so you clearly know you've got a rocket ship at that point. You hit the wave right at the right time.
Yeah. And so
you have some massive scaling challenges then, I suspect, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, my favorite story about that is we needed some real estate. We were just busting at the seams. We were over this coffee shop on South Congress and, you know, I mean, people were having to have meetings in the stairwell kind of thing. And so we wound up moving a couple blocks north to sort of downtown Austin. And I remember the only space I could get at the time was a floor. Like, for whatever, Austin real estate there's a lot of empty space now, I think, but there wasn't at the time. And so you had to take the whole floor. And I didn't need the whole floor. We had like 70 employees. And I thought, I remember telling our COO, we will never use this whole floor. And I think we wound up taking 5 or 6 floors in the building by the end of the thing. But
and how long did it take you to occupy that first floor?
Yeah, not very long. I mean, about a year. Yeah. So we worked with some great people to help us with real estate, which I think is one of the hardest challenges, you know, to try and have enough space where you have enough space for people, but also you're not sitting around looking at the space going, why do I have all this space? Right. And because it's not cheap. Right. And so we got lucky that there's a group here called HPI that was just fantastic in helping us kind of measure all that.
Terrific. Okay. So you shoot up to 100 million. Now you're at an incredible triple digit growth pace. How long did it take you to go public? When did you go public?
Well, we went public 4 years after we started. So pretty.
What was your revenue level at that point? Do you remember?
About 180, I think. You're testing my memory. But yeah.
Okay. So within four years to go from 0 to 180 and going public, that is the theoretical Super Bowl, I guess, if you're playing in the startup world. You know, what was that like? Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, it's everything you've heard. I mean, my favorite story about going public was we had two great investment banks take us public, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and they were lovely and super smart, and we got lucky, and, you know, they did a great job for us. But we were at Fidelity, and the salesperson for one of them was talking to the potential buyer at Fidelity, right? And they had been to a Patriots game or something together, or we're going to go or something like that. And like, I was just kind of sitting there drinking my coffee, listening to them talk. And it dawned on me, I'm the product here.
Yeah, they're selling you.
They're selling me. And it was a weird feeling because, you know, these guys are going to see each other 1,000 more times in their careers or whatever. I'm there a day. You know, I mean, maybe you might be
the flavor of the day and yeah. You know, how much are they going to emphasize you versus what's coming tomorrow?
Right. And you know, and we got amazing advice and I wouldn't change anything we did for the world, but you definitely realize you're the commodity.
Yeah. Well, you went public on which exchange?
NASDAQ.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, the reality is though, but you're joining one of the world's largest marketplaces and you're a new product on the shelf, right? That's exactly
yeah,
what it
yeah.
is.
No, it was just kind of a crazy thing. Yeah, no, yeah. Going public, the other fun thing we did, I thought this was cool. So if you go public on the New York Stock Exchange, you get the famous balcony shot, right?
Right.
And that balcony holds 14 people. And I felt like, you know, at the time we were kind of 400 people, I think maybe 500. And to me, you know, I wanted them all on the balcony, right? And so that seemed ridiculous. And so we talked to NASDAQ and they let us open the stock exchange in Austin at Austin City Limits where they shoot the music.
Oh, fantastic.
TV show. Yeah. And so we had a big party and rang the bell.
How'd you do that?
Yeah, we had a big stage and they, you know, and I'm sure it wasn't connected or anything, but I got to slam the thing and you know, the sirens went off. We had a band. It was super
that's
fun.
Awesome. So you made you made it very inclusive. So your whole team can be part of that.
Yeah,
you had big screens and something amazing.
Bring your family out. I mean, you know, the whole thing, right? So it was
that's fantastic.
It was an amazing day. And I think, you know, so often, I mean, I had the VCs come. I mean, you know, why not? I mean, it's how many times are you gonna go public in your career? You know, so
that's a great story. I'm glad to hear that. Well, you know, I read on your LinkedIn, you know, that you had an incredibly high approval rating on some of those sites like Glassdoor. People really liked working at your company and you were incredibly well liked as a top rated CEO. Was that something you focused on? Like, how did you in this growth, you know, you're obviously adding people, trying to fill out floors and all that. Yeah. But how do you make it a good place to work and make sure that the culture was good, you know, during that rocket ship ride?
I think it's hard. I mean, look, Austin then and now is really competitive. And so it's not enough just to say we're going to pay competitive salaries. I mean, Apple, Facebook, Google are all here. They were coming at that time. And as well, there's a bunch of local great companies. Indeed started and is headquartered here. Dell, of course, the granddaddy of Austin Tech, is here. All amazing companies and great places to work. And so, you know, that's your competition when you're thinking about like a product manager or a full stack engineer or a front end person or something like that. All those people could go any of those places. And, you know, so it's not enough just to say, well, we're going to pay a competitive salary. You have to, I think, build a culture that people go, I want to be part of that. And so we did a couple things. We stole something from Amazon. One of the things I'm most proud of is we stole a thing from Amazon called the Bar Raiser. And so it was a part of the, it was supposedly the last part of your interview process. And we picked, I don't know, I think 10 or 12 people from the company that we felt like represented kind of the best of us. And from a cultural standpoint, and they would interview every candidate, not just exclusively for culture fit. And they had a blackball. And so they could say, this guy, he's not like us. You know, he's not going to make it. He's too cutthroat. He doesn't talk about a team. He talks about himself, whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
so that was the final interview round. You brought in your best culture folks, and then they had to pass the culture bar.
That's exactly right. And I liked That's it. Awesome. I thought it worked pretty well.
And that was across the board. Everyone that was hired. Yeah. Wow, that's not a small commitment.
No, yeah. And inevitably, and you can see this coming 100 miles away, you know, there's somebody you really want to hire that the person blackballs, you know, and then you're like, oh gosh, you know. And so, you know, you would talk to the person, why'd we throw the blackball on Sally? She seemed amazing to me when I interviewed her, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I mean, you'd work through it or you wouldn't, but we honored the process.
Yeah, you have to honor to build.
Yeah, otherwise it's meaningless.
I know it means a ton coming in, though, when you see that in an interview process. Everyone talks about culture, but that's something probably that really speaks pretty loudly in the interviewing process.
No, and it's funny. I think culture is something that we talk about now that for the longest, I mean, I'm older, I'm 62. The longest in my career, culture wasn't talked about. I mean, at least not in any of the companies I was at. You know, it was just it was a job. And so I think it's definitely for the better. And I think it's definitely something we try to focus on, you know, since I've been a CEO. So,
and that's a really good example. You know, there's always the values on the wall and people kind of roll their eyes because sometimes they're not consistently applied. But like the example that you just shared, where you take the effort of using the critical time of some of your best people to be part of that interview process and to give them the chance to blackball people and have to live with that, that's putting your money where your mouth is, I think. That should probably speak volumes.
No, and I couldn't agree more. And, you know, you talk about values. I remember I was at a big retailer who I won't name because I don't want to embarrass anybody. And they had a really well-written set of values that were on the wall of the lobby, right? We were waiting on the person to come pick us up. And I commented to our contact, I'm like, I love your values. And he was like, what are you talking about? And I pointed to the wall and he's like, oh, I've never read those, you know?
Oh,
and
so boy. It was just, wow.
It was so obvious that it was just some marketing hoo-ha and he'd never bought, you know, and he's like, no, I don't know anybody that's ever read that. And so,
oh my goodness.
When we were going to do values at Retail Me Not and at my new company, we actually, I thought it would be more powerful if instead of me coming up with what I think, we built a team of employees and had them say, here's what's important to us. And so I did that at Retail Me Not and I did it again here.
I love that. Well, I'd love to follow up and learn about that technique. But obviously, this is a great story. It sounds like a ton of fun, but I'm sure there's some things that, you know, looking back, that you with the viewpoint you have now and the perspective you have now, that you might have done differently. What kind of lessons might you pull out to someone else who's maybe, you know, we're all aspiring to that kind of rocket ship, but whether they're at the same slope or not, what are some of the lessons you can share and things you might do differently if you did it again?
Yeah, I think, you know, we probably overhired. We didn't probably. We definitely overhired. We struggled to find the right metric for sort of how to think about how many employees we needed to run the business. And I used to have this joke that everybody needs a buddy. There are no one person departments. And so, you know, it's a classic example that you know, you think, I remember I hired someone to run strategy, great guy, super smart. And I look up a year later and he's got six people that were working for him. And that's not his fault. He felt like we needed him. But to me, it was an example of, you know, building out a team that maybe we didn't need. Maybe we did.
How would you handle that now if you were in that situation?
Yeah, we work hard to just, I just don't hire, right? We really have clamped down on, I mean, we hire very, it's a much more, first of all, I've always worked hard to hire in the interview process, but I've pulled that back now into this sort of, let's talk about why you need someone. Right. And so if someone leaves, we don't just automatically rehire for them. You know, we kind of take a step back and say, well, is there something we could do this job? Should we automate it? Should we outsource it? Should we move it offshore? What, you know, is there some other way to do this job that's cheaper and more efficient? And I think that is a lesson that came with time, frankly. And it's easy to get caught up in the kind of startup BS of how many employees do you have? How much money have you raised?
Yeah, the vanity metric, right?
Yeah, and who did you raise it from?
The process that you just described is what would get you to profitability and capital efficiency, for sure.
That's right. And the joke is, Retail Me Now was crazy profitable. And so we probably weren't as, well, not probably, we weren't as aggressive managing cost as you might be in a company that loses money.
Yeah. Well, most people who listen to this podcast are probably venture funded, and they're probably, you know, along the journey where they may still be losing money, and getting to profitability while maintaining growth is really the name of the game. So, you know, what you just said there in terms of really with every hire, do you need that hire? Does it, you know, I love the idea of just replacing someone who's there, because that can sometimes be automatic.
Yeah, right. 100%.
But you just walked through some really good criteria. You know, do you need that person? Do you need that person full time? Do you need that person now? Do you need that person domestically? Right. You said about offshoring, and then can you automate it? I think, you know, those are some great questions to ask in terms of driving, you know, continue your growth, but reducing your cost base as you go along, so you get better profitable or more efficient.
Sure. The other thing that happens, and you know this, rarely. You almost never have someone immediately on deck, right? So if you quit tomorrow and I've got somebody that can start the next day or whatever, right? I mean, that just doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen, right? So your taps.
Right. So in that sort of interim process where the person is left or leaving, but we haven't brought in the replacement, I think it's important to kind of talk to the team. Are we really stressed right now? Or are we kind of doing okay?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we didn't have good discipline on letting people go. We were very disciplined on hiring, but we definitely had people kind of bump along that maybe we should have been more aggressive about. So,
okay, well, that's getting great. Better. So tell me a little bit more about what you're doing now at Expert Voice.
Sure, Expert Voice is kind of a quirky company. So you mentioned it in the opening. We run pro programs for brands, and so the classic example, but it's one of those companies you kind of have to explain for people to go, oh, okay. The example I always use is if you're a ski instructor, you know, ski brands want you to wear their jacket when you're out and about. You know, the resort will give you a jacket, but totally. I mean, you know, when you're out and about or skiing on your own, you know, Helly Hansen wants you to wear their jacket. K2 wants you to wear their skis. I always tell the story. I skied for years in Taos. We grew up skiing there, and I had the same ski instructor for 6 years. And it was this guy named Jim, and Jim skied on Rossignols. And man, I can assure you, when it was time for me to buy my first pair of skis, I was buying Rossignol or, you know, regardless.
I remember that too. That was my first big new set of skis when I was aware enough of brands to make a choice.
So brands need help managing those programs to make sure the ski instructors are qualified, to make sure that they are ski instructors, that kind of thing. And so we do that for them, and we manage that in an e-commerce sort of environment. So if you're a ski instructor, you can come to Expert Voice and you have a ton of brands that want you to represent their stuff, and they're willing to sell you their stuff at a lower price to get you to be in it. And that's true if you're a fireman or a doctor or a nurse or you know, a golf pro. I mean, the list goes on.
That sounds like a kind of a fun area. You're in those aspirational recreational expert areas, right?
Yeah, it's funny. I haven't always been as outdoorsy as I am forced to be now. So we need
to get you up here to Park City for our Growth Elevated conference and do some skiing at Alta with us this year.
I'm sure it's fun.
So tell me about you in our pregame. You were talking about the challenge of being fully remote. You know, you're in Austin. The company's in Salt Lake. You're back and forth. But sometimes, you know, the people aren't in the office in Salt Lake. How are you navigating that? What are your thoughts on you know, pros and cons?
Yeah, we are fully remote. The company was headquartered in Salt Lake. And before the pandemic, I think there were two people out of the 150 or so that worked there that weren't in Salt Lake. And one of them commuted in every week. And then when the pandemic hit, people just scattered. And they moved to Seattle, they moved to Denver, they moved out from, you know Utah better than I, but yeah. Out into the backwoods of Utah, it's beautiful, why not? And so when the pandemic ended, it would be almost impossible to bring the company back together. Coincidentally, that's when we bought the company. I and a private equity firm in Austin called Tritium bought the company about almost exactly 2 years ago. And so there was no, you couldn't put the genie back in the bottle, right? I mean, people were home and we just had to learn to live with it. But as you know, sort of the history of my own experience is very much kind of butts in seats mentality. And this has required us to, as managers, you can't be that way, right? I mean, we were joking before before the call. Literally, you know, if you hadn't had a shower, if you're walking your dog while we talk on the phone, I don't know, you know? I mean, I guess I could hear the traffic or something, but we need to, it's forced us as managers to focus more on outcomes and not on sort of time and seat. And I think that's pretty healthy. There are some jobs where that's super easy. Sales is always the classic example of, you know, did you hit your quota? Yes. Then I kind of don't care if you played golf, you know, Friday afternoon at 4 or something. I don't know. Maybe I do. But old habits are hard to break. But, you know, for something that's trickier, you know, programming, you know, everybody's tried a million things in programming to measure efficiency, but it's still challenging. And so, and operations and things like that can be more challenging to measure, but we're working through it and it's been a fun experience. People are great. The company's really, lovely and it's going well.
Well, I'm excited about, learning more and seeing you here when you're in Utah. It's great to have you part of the Utah ecosystem. You know, speaking of that, the Utah ecosystem is growing, but you played a huge role in the Austin tech scene, both, you know, in the venture capital space, as well as, you know, obviously with Retail Me Not. Talk to me a little bit about what's happening in Austin and what are you most proud of there?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The way I think about it is, when I first moved to Austin, our biggest challenge when recruiting people, if someone was out of state, was the trailing spouse problem. Is how does your husband or wife that works find a job, especially if they were in tech, when you're at Retail Me Not? Yeah. And we really struggled with that at first. There was kind of Dell and Indeed, and that was it. And
yeah,
but now, you know, you kind of never hear that anymore. There's so much going on here. You know, as I mentioned before, you know, Apple, Google, Facebook, TikTok all have pretty enormous offices here. Apple is
one of the top tech markets for employment in the country.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so if you're in tech and you're a trailing spouse, you can get a job if you want one, more than likely. And so that's, to me, so exciting. I love to see that growth. There's a good startup scene here. It used to be that there was just Austin Ventures. It was kind of the only venture firm in town, or certainly the dominant player, maybe a better way to say it. And now there's a lot of really well-established, there's still probably not enough seed capital here, but man, if you're raising an A, you can definitely find people to talk to here. It's still hard to raise money, mm-hmm. of course. Raising money's hard, but and I think that's sometimes lost on entrepreneurs. I do a Q&A for a local newsletter, and the most popular question by far is, you know, how do I raise money? Why am I having trouble? And, you know, not every idea can be funded. Not every idea is a venture idea. So it's still hard.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, I've enjoyed getting to know you through our work together at Next Coast Ventures. And it's a lot of fun to see all the exciting companies that are being incubated and growing in Austin and across the country together. But that's been a real treat for me, and I've enjoyed it. So, Cotto, that was a great story. Thank you for taking the time with us. You know, for the people that are aspiring to have the kind of success that you did, any recommendations you have, books or podcasts that you think that, you know, that you read that you like, that they might put on their list as they're just doing their continual education?
Sure. I would say two things. The thing I think that's helped me as much as anything in my career is, while I started in finance, I then shifted to marketing, and I think having a broader background has really served me well. I got lucky. There's a branch of marketing, direct marketing, that at the time required pretty heavy analytical skills.
Oh, and sure, so, did. Yeah.
Finance background.
Certainly did.
Yeah, so finance background was actually a benefit, not a negative, but you know, that ability to sort of see across the platform has been invaluable. I can't say it enough. And anytime someone comes to me, I'm like, get as much experience in as many different jobs as you can. In terms of podcasts or books, my favorite business book is Shoe Dog. I think you've read it. It's,
yeah, I love it.
Truly amazing. The grit that guy has, the founder of Nike, is just, Phil Knight, is just insane. I mean, his story after story where you just, in the book, where you're just like, what this guy did to put Nike on the map is absolutely the classic example of what it takes to build a business. And I wish I could say I'd worked half as hard as he did. It's truly amazing.
Yeah, that's an awesome story. And you're going to enjoy that movie Air. It's just a chapter in that book, but that's a fun one about the Michael Jordan version, about a chapter of that story. Well, Cotto, thank you so much for your time this morning. I think this was a great story, and I can't wait to continue to work with you to help entrepreneurs in the way we are. And good luck in all your ventures. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, would you please follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast player? And we'd be grateful if you recommend it to a friend. If you'd like more resources on how to become a better leader in business, we invite you to visit us at growthelevated.com. We'll be back next week with more insight from another great tech leader. Thank you.